Welcome back to That One Record. Thanks for joining us here in season two. This week I'm talking to Jeremy Bohm, the lead vocalist from Touche Amore, to talk about 2011's Parting the Sea Between Brightness and Me. I will admit I was a little bit later to getting into this record. As we talk about a lot in the show, this was the time of the wave. All those bands, La Dispute, Touche Amore, Make Two and Men, Title Fight, Tiger Shaw, that whole wave of bands that were all cresting, exploding at the same time. I was a little bit more into the La Dispute, Make Two and Men, a little bit more of the punk world, a little bit of the softer stuff. It took me a little while to dive into the harder stuff like Touche Amore. But this record in particular was the big one for the band in terms of the just exponential growth that they saw over the next few years. This was really the boiling point where this record comes out and it's everywhere. And the thing that really struck me in particular at that time, I had kind of really been into the hardcore scene when I was younger, and it just kind of weeded me out. I just wasn't having a great time at those shows, being around a certain type of person. But Touche Amore was the first time I had heard or seen, it really took seeing them live, a hardcore band like this bringing joy to rooms. And I feel like Jeremy in particular, as we talk about, had a real penetrating style of writing. He really goes deep, kind of lays it all out, and that really connects and resonates with people. Maybe not always in the most healthy way, as you'll see, but that in particular, it was just, you know, this connection, this passion, this fun. It was something I missed deeply in the heavier, faster music scene that I was starting to see again. You know, a band like 7 Seconds is one of my absolute favorites, and while the music may not be very similar at all, the vibes certainly are. They go on to put out a bunch of phenomenal records. Stage 4, they signed Epitaph. They are constantly touring. They're such an important band now in heavy music. And Jeremy was incredibly gracious, giving us just a ton of his time here to really, really hash out from the beginning how Parting the Sea was made, but also how it forever changed Touche Amore and what they would end up being. We talk the incredibly hectic and fast recording process. We talk about the time he spent hanging out in the Death Wish offices, you know, getting in on some of the lore and seeing the behind-the-scenes stuff and eventually ending up putting records out on Death Wish, how they signed Epitaph. We really dig down deep and trace how Jeremy got to where he is today. He'll also mention at the end of the show, just in case you don't make it that far, Jeremy has his own podcast called The First Ever Podcast, and it's an interview-style podcast, digs deep with tons of amazing artists, you know, past guests on this show. Tom May from the Menzingers was a recent episode. He really goes in deep. It's got a great Patreon page that gives you a bunch of extra features, stuff like that. So if that's your bag, I highly, highly suggest checking that out as well. But for now, we're going to start off right at the beginning, right from To the Beat of a Dead Horse, member swaps, all of it, the backstory of how Touche Amore was able to put together Parting the Sea Between Brightness and Me and how it got them to where they are today. June 7th, 2011, Parting the Sea Between Brightness and Me comes out on Death Wish, but I want to start with To the Beat of a Dead Horse. So I was listening to your podcast, The First Ever Podcast, and you were talking about how I couldn't tell if it was before you recorded or after. Basically, your drummer at the time was like, I'm out, I quit. Was that kind of like, were you thinking this was maybe just going to be a one and done type thing?
Yeah. So, you know, when we did To the Beat of a Dead Horse, we were, you know, especially in the grand scheme of things, like we were such a small band, and we had written like, okay, just like to take you back a little further. Like, yep. There's a song on Dead Horse called Suckerfish, which actually was supposed to be on the demo, but our original drummer at the time forgot to track it.
Also named Jeremy, right?
Is this also named Jeremy? Okay. Yeah, Jeremy Zupnik, but he always goes by Z. So okay. He was always known around everywhere as just Z. I don't even know that I don't think I've ever in my life ever called him Jeremy. Like he was just always Z. Anyway, so we went in to record the demo and we had all of those songs already. And yeah, Suckerfish, I think, was one of the last songs that we had written around the time of the demo. So then when time is money, everything is, you're only in a studio for a certain amount of time. So we went out to the spot out in Riverside, California. I don't know if it's still there, but it's called Love Juice Laboratories, which is a terrible name. But it was like the spot where it's like, oh, if you spend, if you give them $200 or $250, you can knock out a decently sounding recording. So we went out there, time is money, we're only supposed to be there for, I think, 2 days, maybe a day, probably a day, to be honest. And, so it went, Clayton goes to go do guitar tracks or Tyson goes to do guitar tracks. And we're like, wait a second.
Oh no,
we're missing a song. And it was like, Z had already broken down his drums. Like he was already out of there. So it was like, well, that sucks. So anyway, we went in to do dead. We did minimal stuff with that 7-inch. We played shows locally. We did like 2 brief West Coast tours, which were just, up to Washington and back, playing to, a handful of people. So and then, before we started, I think it was before we started recording, you told me you were in a band that had a moment on the Bridge 9 board, similar sort of thing. Like, we caught a little bit of steam on the Bridge 9 board. My best friend, runs the label 6131 Records. So he was kind enough to let us, put out Dead Horse on his label. But what we're getting at here is it's like Z had, decided he didn't want to be in the band anymore. But his whole thing was, I'll record Dead Horse, but I don't want to be credited as your drummer. He's like, I don't want to be listed as like a band member. So that's why if you look at the liner notes for that record, it's like the 4 of us. And then it says drums by Jeremy Zupnik. Cause he didn't want to say that he didn't want to be affiliated with us as a band.
Okay.
So it was strange. So that was fine. So then it was during the recording, I think. So also we decided to go record the record just for honestly for posterity, just because we were so proud of those songs where it's like, it'd be a bummer not to hear these recorded. Alex Estrada, who's been a long time collaborator with us, recorded that record. So it was going in with a friend. I think that was the first time we actually recorded with him though. But he's gone on to he does pre-production for every single one of our records. We legitimately record our entire album before we go to Brad Wood or Ross Robinson. We've done that historically with Alex. He's also recorded a lot of our split songs, or cover songs just throughout the years. And, so we went to him, knocked it out in a couple days, and Jeff Eaton from Modern Life is War, was kind enough to sing on that record. And it was him. I don't think it was as cinematic as while we were in the studio, he had this, helpful conversation or something, but it might've just been in passing or something like that. But I remember telling Jeff, I think we're just kind of doing this for us. I don't think we're going to continue, Z left the band. And he just had a very so get a fucking different drummer. And it was this thought that couldn't even enter our brains, because Z, for all of the issues he and I may have had, he's a fucking incredible drummer. His drumming style, Elliot is one of my favorite drummers in the entire world. And I'm, fucking kiss my lucky stars that Elliot, we found Elliot and he joined the band. But he and Elliot are very different drummers. If you listen to the drumming style on that record to the drumming style that Elliot has, they're super different. And Z's talent was remarkable. So the idea of not having Z in the band was oh my God, how could we ever continue? So where I'm getting at is we had a few fill-ins. We had a couple fill-ins after Z left the band while we did shows for around the time of Dead Horse. When we played Sound and Fury 2009, we had a fill-in playing when a gentleman named Alex. And then we had this kid, Jackson, do a tour with us. He plays in this pretty respected tech metal band called Black Sheep Wall. Okay. That has records out and stuff like that. So It's funny too, because we actually invited Jackson to join the band. Like, we were like, dude, Jackson rips. He's like the nicest fucking dude. We're like, Jackson, do you want to join Touche? And he was like, no, I'm good.
So you start with a great drummer, you find another one.
Yeah.
So you've basically hit, now how do you find Elliot? Because to hit three incredible drummers is nuts.
Yeah.
It's usually the hardest spot to fill.
Totally. So actually, if I remember, now that I'm like putting the timeline in my head, it went Z, then it had to have been Jackson, which is weird to think about that Jackson was before Onyate. That's so weird. My brain is all over the place. Anyway, it's I guess it makes sense in the story. So then Onyate plays with us, and we have the Thursday tour. We get a tour with Thursday. It's like our first big tour. For, you know, we're playing First of Four. It's like Thursday, Fall of Troy, and the Deer Hunter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And we're like, fuck, like, we got to do this tour. And Alex ends up like pretty last minute not being able to do it. And so we're like, fuck, we have to figure something out. So I was at a barbecue at Joey from 6131's house. And our buddy Sam, who at the time was playing in Trash Talk, he's been in so many bands. He's filled in for Ceremony. He's filled in for Power Trip. He's filled in for, Literate Merchandise. So many bands. He played in the band Lock. Anyway, he's like a drummer legend guy in California. I'm at a barbecue and I'm like, Sam, do you know anybody who could do this? Anybody, almost probably hoping that Sam would say he would do it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, yo, Sam, do you have anyone who can get us out of this bind? And he was like, I have a friend who is up in college in Santa Cruz, who might be down. And they knew each other through the Aquabats message board. They met through ska, which is incredible.
It's making a comeback. So
yeah, right. So he was like, I'll ask my friend Elliot, and Elliot got the call and literally just like left college. Like, he was like kind of over college at the moment, and we talked very briefly over email. I think those emails are in the Dead Horse X book. But literally, we like sent him the songs, and he listened to the songs on the drive down from the Bay to band practice. He showed up in like, you know,
just
famously
ripped
short shorts, and but he had a rat tail. He had like the rat tail. He was like very crust punk looking kid, big glasses with like what do you call it? The ocular retainer in the back.
Oh yeah,
like he had that going. We're just
the
like this kid.
Strap.
Yeah, exactly. Wearing, I think he was wearing like a, probably like a DOS Oath shirt. We're just like, fuck, man, this kid is wild. Sat down behind the drums and played our songs 40 times faster than they should have been.
Yeah.
But we were like, dude, this kid has energy and he's so funny. So we're like, let's go with it. So we threw him in the van, and it's funny, between him and Tyler, who kind of joined around the same time because our guitar player then quit, and Nick moved from guitar to bass around that time. Like, I don't know that we ever actually officially had the conversation with Tyler or Elliot about joining the band. They're just in the band.
They're just there.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know that. I think we were maybe it was like the blowback of inviting Jackson and him saying no. We're like, maybe we just don't ask and they just stick around forever.
They'll just stay. Yeah. So then you've got your guy.
Yeah.
You've got bass now sorted out. Nick moves back to guitar.
To guitar. He was always just originally the bass player.
Oh,
he played bass.
Okay,
So he played bass on the demo, and then I think did some guitar stuff on Dead Horse, just like punching in stuff, maybe when Tyson wasn't available to do it. But Nick was always a guitar player. He's like he was just like always a phenomenal guitar player.
Rips. Yeah, yeah.
But the funny story there is we actually, and I had invited his best friend in the entire world, this guy Dewey, to play bass. And Nick, knowing that Dewey is a flaky person, was like, I'm just going to fucking do it. Cause like, so Nick tells a story where Dewey was like, yo, like Jeremy invited me to like be in some like dumb screamo band.
Oh,
I don't know
no.
if I want to do it. And Nick was like, all right, I'll do it. He just like took Dewey's gear and brought it to band practice. Like, he came with Dewey's bass and played, and we were like, all right, sick, you know?
So you've got your group now. So then parting, I assume you're writing at this time, but when does Death Wish come into the equation for this? Because you jumped to Death Wish at this point.
Right. And this is at a point, like, I don't think that there was ever a conversation between myself and Joey at 6131 about, like, leaving the label or anything like that. Like, I always looked at him putting out Dead Horse as us, as him just doing his friend a solid.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he was, I don't think he was, like, banking on, oh, fuck, I hope I get to do the new Touche record.
Right.
Because at the time, like, he's putting out Cruel Hand, he's putting out Down Presser, he's putting out, like, you know, very, very beloved, respected, like, hardcore records. And we were the outlier. And again, I don't think that had anything to do with, like, his thoughts on the band. He was happy to support us. But what I'm getting at is, like, I don't think he gave a shit that, like, we were going to potentially go elsewhere.
Yeah.
So we played Sound and Fury 2009. And right after the set, Trey McCarthy, who's co-owner of Death Wish with Jake Bannon, approached us at the merch table and, you know, was like, hey, how do I get your records in our web store? What's your story? Blah, 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 blah. And I was just, like, so taken back because I'm, as, like, a fanatic of the label,
yeah.
I had always known who Trey was, you know, and his personality, was also always sort of talked about as, like, this very grumpy guy, like grumpy Uncle Trey. So I, you know, he immediately, like, ball busted us or something because he was under the impression that Jeff Rickley was the only person who put out that record. Like, cause Jeff had done the collect thing, but the record was like 99% put out by 6131.
Okay.
Jeff basically just, like, helped introduce our band to certain people, which was, like, extremely helpful and very, you know, valuable. And he took us on tour. So, like, that was more so Jeff's role in the situation, but, like, Joey handled all, like, the actual record label stuff. So, you know, Trey came up to the table and was like, how do I get your records in our web store? I don't know how to talk to famous people. Like, that was his, like, dickhead thing to say. So I was like, dude, you could just get it from fucking Joey. And he was like, oh, okay. So anyway, our friendship started there. You know, we started exchanging emails, things like that. Also, what kind of helped, not like just another adding factor to everything. So around the same time, we never had a booking agent. I always did all of I booked all of our shows, honestly, mostly through the Bridge Nine board, you know, that was at the era, you know, sort of this, like, MySpace was fizzling out. Instagram didn't exist yet. You know, Twitter, I don't even remember when that god awful site started, but anyway, it was like around that time. So, like, it was so helpful to just, like, post all of the dates we were hoping to do on, like, the Bridge Nine board.
Yeah.
And then people would just comment being like, I can get you a show here, I can get you a show here, whatever. So I'm doing all the booking, and around that time, a gentleman named Merrick Yarmolowitz approaches us through
Is that Ground
Trey.
Control touring?
Yes. Yeah, okay. But at the time it was Jesus Christ.
Hey, is like a decade ago now.
Yeah. Oh my God, what was it called? But it's basically, it was Merrick and his partner was Matt Pike. And not obviously, like, guitar player Matt Pike, not High on Fire Matt Pike, booking agent Matt Pike. So they shared an office in the Death Wish office. They had a space in there.
Oh, okay.
So Matt always booked Converge and a ton of respectable hardcore bands. And Merrick was his partner who did all, like, he started kind of doing all, like, the younger bands. He had some, like, pretty large acts himself. Like, I think he booked Bane, things like that. But Merrick, you know, I think Trey introduced us to be, yes, he did. I'm putting it all together now. So Merrick had started booking Title Fight.
Oh,
and,
okay.
So Title Fight was coming out to do two shows for Epitaph because they were originally going to sign to Epitaph around 2010,
Whoa. 2011. did not know that.
Yeah. I'm just spoiling all the inside baseball here, but they wouldn't give a shit. I'm sure they've talked about this before. So, Epitaph was trying to sign Title Fight. So they brought him out to the West Coast to do two shows. And the only other time they'd ever been out here was for Sound and Fury. So, Merrick was booking the shows. They played Chain Reaction and they played the Shea Cafe. and Merrick was like, put us on the shows. And that was when I met Merrick for the first time in person.
Oh, cool.
at the Shea Cafe. And we, you know, got to talking or whatever. That's also the time our friendship with Title Fight actually started. And we got along really, really well. And then he had like cold feet for a while where he was like, he's like, he was doing the thing, you know, where like someone is doing all of the, they're doing the job, but they're afraid to commit, you know, it's like any
drummer.
Relationship. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like so he was like, literally like sending us offers, giving me advice, like being like, hey, this person wants to take you out. Hey, what do you think of this? You know, and he was an incredible person for advice. I would go as far as to say, like, he was borderline our manager before we met our manager, who we also met through Merrick. Merrick introduced us to him.
Okay.
So, you know, he was like playing this large role. And then, you know, after a while, I was just like, dude, shit or get off the pot. Like, let's fucking go. Like, what? Like, why don't you just commit to it? And then I think another booking agent approached us and I hit up Merrick. I was like, hey, this person just hit us up. And he's like, okay, fine. I guess I'll do it.
Yeah.
So, what I'm getting at is, because I'm going, you invited me to just blather, no, so I'm blathering. Yep. So yeah, they're sharing an office with Deathwish. There was a point in between tours where it made more financial sense for me to stay on the East Coast with our van and have the other guys fly home for a few weeks than
drive all the way back.
And then exactly. Yeah. It made just more financial sense. I mean, this was for years. Like, we were so stoked if we got $150 a night. Like, we were, you know, but we wouldn't have known better. You know what I'm saying? Yep. Like, yep. For us, we're like, hey, is our gas covered? Holy shit. We made $300 in merch. Yeah, like, yeah. We're fucking rich. So sleeping on floors, obviously not spending money on anything besides gas. So, the dudes flew home and I stayed on Merrick's couch for like 2 weeks, which meant I'm going to the Deathwish office every single day and literally just hanging out.
Yeah.
And so Mike got to know everyone else who worked in the office. And around that same time, we were approached by a couple different labels. We were approached by Bridge Nine and we were approached by Equal Vision. And we stopped by the Equal Vision office on a tour. They have a, I forget which merch company they're with. Merch Direct, maybe. Could be Merch Direct, one of those two. Anyway, I forget which one is Justin Beck from Glass Jaws. Merch, much merch. I don't know. Whoever's listening, you do the math here. Yeah. Yeah, whatever merch company they shared an office with or co-owned, we stopped by. We were kind of just hoping to raid their merch warehouse and take a bunch of shirts. And they told us we could each only have one, which probably played a role in us not signing to Equal Vision. We're like, stingy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, they were really nice. There was a person there named Francesca who was like incredibly kind and very supportive of the band and continued to be supportive of the band as we didn't sign with them. We really liked the people at Bridge Nine. But, you know, such a built-in history with like the love for Deathwish. All of us are huge Converge fans. And also I'm getting to see the operation every day. I'm getting to like hang out with these people every single day, which does play a huge role in why we ended up there, you know?
Yeah.
There was like a day, I was always so intimidated by Jake. And there was a day where I can even show you, which doesn't help for the podcast at all. but there was a day where Jake had found a stack of original pressings of You Fail Me, but no jackets, just the actual LPs.
Oh, okay.
He found like a stack of them.
Yeah.
And decided he wanted to make like a silkscreen cover for them. And it was like, so he found a stack of those and he found a stack of Power and the Glory records.
Oh, cool.
And was like, I'm going to make just silkscreen covers, throw them up online. They'll sell out in fucking 5 seconds.
Yeah,
I'm going to hand number them or whatever. And I'm a fucking huge vinyl kid and on top of that, a huge Converge collector. So I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe this is, you know, so cool, whatever. So like Merrick was super busy that day, you know, taking meetings or calls or whatever the hell. And I was like, I'm just going to go ask Jake if he needs help packaging these. Yeah. So I walked over and I was like, hey, can I help you with this? And he was like, okay. So, and he and I hadn't really talked
at all at this point.
Yeah. So he and I stood next to each other and I helped him pack these records, just the two of us, which then led me to get to ask all of the like deep inside baseball Deathwish questions that I always wanted to know, you know, like some of the nerdiest shit ever. You're wearing a cursed shirt right now. I don't know if you remember this, but Chris Callahan was supposed to put out a book on Deathwish early on, and it was called Other People's Girlfriends.
Yeah.
And it was apparently this like super gnarly book of essays. There was even a point where like they had a banner made for it. Like you know, it was like old, you know,
okay,
like
the, so the, like, yes, yeah, yeah.
Like it was like teasing that this book was coming.
It's coming.
So like
yeah.
So I remember being like, what happened with that book? He told me everything. He's like, he was excited about it, then got cold feet, was excited about it, and then got cold feet, and then we never talked about it. You know, like,
yeah.
It's not the most exciting story, but it was like, what happened to that book? or like, why didn't you guys complete the Dead Man's Hands series, which was like those split 7 inches you know, like they never made the heart one. And I famously have always been like, let us do that. Like, it makes sense for us to have the heart.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I pitched us in Modern Life is War. I pitched us in American Nightmare. I pitched us in Converge. I was like, let us fucking do that. But their excuse for not letting us do it was always that, which does make sense in retrospect, which I think is cool. Which is all of the bands on that series are bands that are not actually signed to Deathwish. They're all they're all friend bands.
Yes.
So
yeah,
it's like
yeah.
Terror, Ringworm, First Blood, Blacklist. Blacklisted at the time wasn't on Deathwish.
Okay.
And then same with HopeCon. It was HopeCon Suicide File. So, you know, whatever. I still think it's fucking bullshit that they haven't completed it. And my brain is broken because of it. So like Trey and so Jake and I are just like shooting the shit and talking, and then Trey comes over and joins the conversation, and the three of us are just like getting in the weeds of like so much stuff. I'm getting so much lore. I'm having just like the best time. And that was like that for me personally was the moment where I was like, I couldn't think of a cooler label to, you know, like they had expressed interest. They wanted us to do it. And they're so, you know, sort of punk minded about it, like, you know, probably to their detriment, but in the sense of like that, you know, we never signed a contract with them. Like that was never anything they were interested in, you know. Yeah. Everything was a handshake deal. They were just like, yeah, it's fucking, you know, we're like, contracts are lame kind of a thing.
So when you go to do the record, do they give you a budget, or you just say, hey, we want to do it here, and they just cover it? Or
there was a quote unquote budget. I mean, this is, if money is so small, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, but again, to us,
even having a budget,
holy
is
fuck.
Crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I believe our budget was $5,000 to go make a record.
Okay.
Which is a lot of money for us, especially, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, I've talked about this in passing over the years, but like, when we signed to Deathwish, we, you know, purposely didn't want to do what everyone would have expected us to do, which was have Jake do our art and record the record with Kurt Ballou.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
As much as that's a dream, I would love to have Kurt do. I'd love to do a record with Kurt one day with any band. You know what I'm saying? I'm just like, we are all love the guy and love his recordings. But also him, you know, geographically wouldn't make sense for us. $5,000 to get to the East Coast and record a record. It's like, $2,500 of that budget is already gone just getting out there.
Yeah,
we got to still find a place to stay, all of that sort of stuff. So that wasn't really in the cards for us. And we have a guitar player who's a graphic design artist, you know, so it's like having Jake do it doesn't really make sense.
So how did you land on Ed Rose?
So we're thinking of people, and he's someone that has always been on our radar. There's a record from the Casca Lottery called Survival is for Cowards, which is like, I would argue, one of the best sounding albums within this genre of the last 20 years. Sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. It's an incredible record. And sonically, you know, does a lot of the like tricks that we do, you know. It's like very like the melodies are extremely bright. But the rhythm section is extremely heavy, which is like, exactly the sound that we're looking for. But we at the time didn't even know that's the sound we were looking for, only made Dead Horse, which is like, you know, pretty primitive in a lot of ways. Like the melody on that record exists, but it's like not at the forefront like it would be going forward.
Yeah, the Small Brown Bike stuff is similar like that too. Those were like, they were in that punk world, but those records always sounded different. They didn't sound like the Hot Water Music records. They didn't sound like the other stuff that was coming from McTernan or whoever else was popular at that time. Was still popular, great producer. Is Ed Rose, was he working out of that Get Up Kids studio at this time?
Yeah, so they had a space which was co-owned by the Pope brothers and Ed Rose. It's called the Black Lodge, which I think at one point was called the Red Lodge, which is confusing.
Yeah.
I think maybe before they owned it, it was the Red Lodge, but it's in Eudora, Kansas. So for any Get Up Kids fans out there, they have a B-Sides collection record called Eudora,
which we realized.
We're like, oh, that's why it's called this. So Eudora. I remember sending Survival is for Cowards, the recording, to Trey, and Trey, of course, knows who like Coalesce is and things like that. You know, if we were like, hey, Trey, what am I going to do with the guy who did the Coalesce records? He'd be like,
sure.
Why? What would people be like? Why? Like, you don't sound like that. Or, but you know. But if we're like, hey, did the Get Up Kids stuff? He'd be like, okay. But we sent him that. I sent him that Survival is for Cowards. I was like, I don't know if you've ever listened to this record. And he texted me back like right away. He was like, holy shit, this thing sounds incredible.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, let's. We'd love to do this. So, you know, Trey and Ed talked. You know, this was unfortunately at a time where, beloved record producers are realizing that like money in the music business is like not what it used to
going away. Yeah.
So, you know, saying, hey, you want to record this band for, you know, probably $4,500 or something like that, you know, would you do it? So he agreed, but it was like, yeah, but you have 3 days, you know, you're doing this record.
Yeah. I heard you talk about how fast you guys did this.
Yeah.
Is it 5 days from basically when you get there to when it is done?
I don't remember being there for 5 days. I genuinely remember pulling in. So there's an apartment above.
Okay.
Very bare bones apartment, you know, feels like an attic.
Yeah.
And it feels like an attic that had some beds. You know what I'm saying? So we showed up at night. He let us in, gave us a quick tour of the space. And we were like, this is so beautiful. I remember in the upstairs apartment area. No, never mind. It's in the studio. In the live room area, they had they have like the big painting that's on that's the cover of On a Wire, the Get Up Kids record. It's like above the door. We're looking at, you know, the Pope drums and stuff like that. We're like, oh man, these are the record. This is the drums that they've recorded. We're just like so starstruck by everything. It's also our first time in like a legitimate studio, you know?
Right.
So we get let into the studio. We get to sleep and then we wake up and, I can't express how small Eudora is. It's one street. It's like basically like there, I don't think there's a stoplight. It's just like you exit and then it's like a small, you know, there's houses there, of course, but like the main street was the studio, the post office, a Chinese / Mexican restaurant and a diner. So it's like, you know, woke up, went to the diner, got some breakfast, walked to the studio. We're just like, let's get going. We recorded the record. All the music was done live. There was no pre-production. We had recorded some of the songs with Alex Estrada and sent them to Ed just to get some feedback. The feedback we got was extremely helpful, which was, you need to add another verse to Home Away From Here, because the original recording of Home Away From Here is like 40 seconds long. It's like genuinely so short.
Yeah.
And Ed heard it and was like, this is hooky as fuck. You need to like add at least another one of these. And he like made it, he like cut it up on like his Pro Tools or something like that.
Right.
And just like added another verse and sent it to us. And he did the same thing with the song Once Needs, was like, you should add this extra part here too. So we're like, yeah, of course, we'll do that. So we recorded all of the music. I'm assuming in a day and a half. I'm assuming the first day was probably, if I'm remembering, like, was probably getting tones and drums set up and making the drums sound good. And then we probably recorded half the songs the first day, second half the next day, and then, or like the rest the next day. And then the third day I did all of the vocals, and then the fourth day was mixing. Yeah. So I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
And it was like a trip. I mean, you know, he was, I'll always say we love Ed. I talk to Ed, you know, at least once a year. We try to see him every time we come through Kansas. He's the coolest fucking dude, but you know, he can be a little grumpy, a little rough around the edges. And I remember, he was trying to stream a basketball game while he was mixing the record, and his internet wasn't working, and he was really mad about that. I also remember one song in the record that I did write in the studio, which was Condolences. Like, I hadn't figured out exactly what I wanted to fully say yet, and so I was up late trying to figure out that. And the next morning, like, everybody went down to the studio because they were doing the second day of recording the music. And I was still in the apartment area, like work, or I sleep, you know, I was dragging ass. I was like, I was like, these guys are doing music. Who gives a shit? You know, I don't need to be there. So I'm like kind of dragging ass. And I got a call. I think I got a call from Ed being like, where are you? And I was like, oh, I'll be down in a minute. He was like, we're not starting until you get here. He was like, we don't do shit until everyone is in the room. I was like, oh,
okay.
Which is cool. You know, I like that. He's like, no, everyone needs to be present. But, what did you do in your band? What did you said you play drums?
Drums. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Did your singer just sing, or did they play music?
They also played music. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cause let me tell you, being a singer in a band, it's fucking boring in the studio until you have to do something. You're just like sitting on a couch looking at the screen with the person with their back turned to you. You know, you're just like, what the fuck do I do?
I used to love recording drums when nobody was there. I used to like to go in first, do it on my own.
Yeah.
And when they got there, I didn't have to deal with anybody. No one had to deal with me. Did you not make the drum decisions?
Yeah, you didn't make any, you weren't playing to a scratch.
No, just like a click track.
Wow. Respect.
No, I had a producer way back in the early days force me to do it. I had never done it before. And he's like, this is how we record. This is how you're going to do it. And then I just spent like a month or two just doing it all to the clicks. And then now I don't want to hear anything else. I want just me. Especially the type of music we play. Like, Elliot drives the show.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a crazy, wild, fast part, he's doing it. If it's going to come back, slow down, he's doing it more than anybody else. So for me, it's like same thing. It's like I'm driving this bus. If I know what I'm doing, everybody else will be there. And it gives them more room to mess around, I feel like. But not everyone agrees.
Yeah. So solidarity to the band members who have to just like sit and listen and just be like,
make bad suggestions.
Yeah, exactly. So, we knocked out the record in 4 days, and then we didn't have gas money to drive home. So I called Trey, and I said, can you please send us another 150 or 200 bucks to get us home? And he did, which is nice. Yeah.
Later recording experiences, I know budget time was a restriction, but do you guys still record like that? Or I guess now it sounds like with Ross and stuff, it's way more intensive do you guys just rip it?
No, we went from recording Dead Horse in 2 days to recording, demo in like 1 day, Dead Horse in 2 days, Party of the Sea in 5 days to, Is Survived By in 2 weeks. We did that in 2 weeks. And that wasn't live. Like that was actually, tracked. You know, we did that. That was our first time track by track. And then, stage four was a month, I want to say, which was awesome.
Yeah.
We recorded drums at a different studio for that, which was awesome. Like we had more budget to like go and,
that's play, the first Epitaph record?
Yeah, okay, yeah, exactly. Yes. We had some of that Epitaph money, so we were like, let's play. Yeah. Let's play around a little bit. And I know Brad was excited about having that Epitaph money, too, compared to the Survive By budget to the Stage 4 budget. And then fucking Lament was... I don't even know, man. That was like overtime, probably 2 months.
Yeah.
Overtime. I mean, because we weren't in there every single day, but we were probably right. we were probably in there just about every single day for at least a month and a half, at least 6 weeks. And then the mixing and just adding stuff and redoing vocals when when trauma happened, Ross just would be like, let's fucking, like I had written there's like a line in Limelight about my dogs dying, and then like they were, because they were like old senior dogs, and then like after I'd recorded the vocals for that, the last one did pass away, and then Ross called me and was like, we should probably re-record that line. I'm like, you just want all of the saddest shit possible. But I was like, I get it. I understand. Yeah. I know where your brain's coming from. But I was like, you opportunistic fuck.
When you guys are writing these records, are you writing together? Like, specifically for Parting, are you guys in a room jamming out? Or someone bringing stuff to practice almost fully formed?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm pretty sure it was, I don't think anyone had, my band can correct me later. I don't think anyone had ever come and fully formed ideas yet. I think that it was still just bringing riffs and then we built from the riffs. I know that Nick had a large part of Home Away From Here. Anytime we have like an ultra pop song, like poppier song,
Nick's there.
It's always Nick. Nick had a big part of Home Away From Here. Nick had a big part in like Reminders is a hella Nick song, you know, things like that.
Okay.
So, I think we were still just writing riff, like someone brings a riff and then we just build it from there. This was pre-iPhone. So, I was recording when we were writing songs. I remember I was bringing a shitty digital camera in to like just film us so that I could pull the audio from it.
And right.
yeah. Which just sounded like that. It was just like, and then, you know, I'd send that to everybody. So we sort of remembered how things kind of sounded. But yeah, I think we wrote it pretty, I don't think it took too long. I mean, when I look at the trajectory and like, the output that we had, especially in those first like 7 years, it just blows my mind. Cause it was like, you know, it was like the amount of fucking touring we were doing. We were touring so much. And then it was like between touring and then it was like record, ton of touring, couple 7 inches, record, ton of touring, couple 7 inches, record, ton of touring, couple 7 inches. Yeah. You know, it's like, it was so consistent. I think that we probably wrote the record within like 2 months or something like
Wild.
That.
Do you and Nick work together at all on the artwork, or do you just say, hey, here's the record, and he just takes it from there?
We have an incredibly close working relationship when it comes to the art, where as soon as lyrics start kind of coming together, I'm sending them to Nick right away so he can start pulling ideas. Okay. And then... we have a friend named Ryan Aylesworth, who's a photographer, who's done work on every record. I don't know if he did any photography, because George from Deaf Heaven did photography for the Lament artwork. But previous to that, like Ryan shot the mountain range photo for Party of the Sea, and he also shot the band photo for the cover of his Survive By.
Oh, okay.
He had Ryan go out and, you know, just take pictures or whatever. Once Nick starts getting ideas, formulating ideas, then he's sending them, then he'll eventually like kind of show me, sort of a mood board of a thing on like what he wants to go off of. And then we start, you know, I'll go over to his place and then we'll sit around and drink coffee and he'll like pitch ideas or show me stuff and whatever. And we'll kind of bounce back and forth. You know, I was at his place when I hand wrote all of the lyrics for the lyric side of like in the insert there. There's a line in it that I forgot to write, which still haunts me. It's just missing.
Okay.
It's just not there. I think it's in amends for anyone who wants to go look at that and see and where it. I'm an idiot. Yeah, I think it's a men's. But also it might be like, ooh, that's cryptic. He didn't write it. Why didn't he write it?
Right,
you know, it's like, oh, it's literally just because I forgot.
How did you guys settle on the singles? Because from what I could find, it looks like you released Amends, Home Away From Here, and Tilled before the record dropped.
What's funny is I don't remember any other singles besides Home Away From Here because we made a music video for it.
That's what I'm trying, because this is right at no one's buying CDs, vinyl, whatever, kind of the little vinyl resurgence. Still some downloads, but we haven't fully transitioned into streaming yet. So kind of debuting songs was still
a different world. Yeah, our buddy Derek Woods, who's a really good photographer, he had made us this video through a series of photographs thing for another, maybe it's for a commercial. He was doing commercial work. I can't remember what it was for, but I was like, holy fuck, we should do a music video like that, where it's just like a series of photos put to this. So we threw him in the van with us and we did a West Coast tour. We played like Fresno, Santa Cruz, San Luis Obispo, like a house show there. It was a series of shows. We just threw him in the van with us and he just kind of documented it the whole time, which was like a lot of fun. I think we literally just did Home Away From Here. That was it. And then we got the Title Fight summer tour, which was Title Fight Touche, The Men Zingers, and Dead End Path.
Oh yeah.
And that was in support of Shed coming out. So I think our record was supposed to come out like a week into the Shed tour. So we purposely leaked our record.
Yeah, I remember this. Yes.
Yeah. Just so people could hear it.
If you pre-ordered it, didn't it come with a download instantly?
Oh, that could make sense. Yeah. I mean, Deathwish would have been down with that. Yeah, they wouldn't have given a shit. There was a site called like it-leaked.com or something that you had to have like the invite to or something, like, you know, things would pop up there. So I remember leaking it to there myself. And cause I think we also had leaked Dead Horse. But I mean, this was also the time where, I mean, yeah, you mentioned Vinyl Resurgence. Like Vinyl Resurgence was definitely like popping then for sure, especially for us. We have always been very, very, very fortunate that like our listener base.
The site.
Yeah, we crashed the Deathwish site for Dead Horse, and then we crashed the Deathwish site for Is Survived By, which was, it's like simultaneously exciting and very frustrating, you know?
People are like just yelling at you like it's your fault.
Yeah, or just exciting because you're like, holy fuck, there's this many people that want it. But then after like 4 hours of people complaining, and then Deathwish tells you, yeah, we only got like 16 orders before everything crashed. You're like, oh, okay, that's fucked up. Okay, this needs to be settled because that's not very good.
Yeah. So I found here, sorry, what I was talking about. It looks like you guys released Amends first on Rock Sound website in March. Then you released Home Away From Here video, Alternative Press, and then Tilled came out in April also on Alternative Press. Just the audio to stream. Which seems like, doesn't it seem wild now to remember like website debuts and features and stuff like that, instead of just Spotify playlists or whatever now?
Yeah, I mean, we're still hanging on to the era of, like, you know, websites doing the debut, like Pitchfork or Stereo Gum. Like, that'll happen, but it always is with a music video. It's weird to think of just audio.
Yeah,
that's weird.
Because I remember hearing Tilled was like, that was my entrance. I was like, whoa, what is this? I had not... To Beat of a Dead Horse was not on my radar yet.
Sure.
And then I heard Tilda. I was like, holy... And I was like, oh, it's just like... This is hardcore bands who just like play Fenders and use reverb.
I like this.
And then the record came out. It's just for me personally, because this is the wave, as they say. Like, at this point, I'm a big Make Doing Men fan.
Okay.
Just barely Title Fight's on the radar, La Dispute, and then this one comes too. So
did you know all these bands at this time, or are you guys meeting as people are starting to call you all the Wave and this group of bands?
It was all very serendipitous where, like, you know, I booked Law Dispute's first West Coast shows in 2009. I think Jordan and I just figured that out when we chatted on my show. So that was 2009 we met. And then, like, on that US tour that Thursday took us on, we left that tour and, like, our last shows with them were in Houston. So then we circled the rest of the US doing DIY shows and played Baltimore for the first time, and Pianos was on our show. So we met Pianos that night and we stayed with them or something. And then met Make Do and Mend also in 2009. We were doing a West Coast tour, it would have been 2009. And then, like, because there was a fest that the Comadre guys did called Kinda Like a Fest in the Bay. That had, like, us, Punch, Comadre, Shook Ones, Make Do and Mend, like a pretty stacked lineup especially for that era.
Yeah.
And we wanted to just keep going north, and we realized that, like, Make Do and Mend were literally booking the exact same dates as us, so we just combined shows. So that's how we met those dudes and hit it off right away. So then that's why, like, 2010, we have a split 7-inch with Make Do and Mend and Law Dispute, because, like, those friendships are forming. We met Defeater. I think that we played West Coast shows with them in 2010? And they were with a band called All Teeth, which featured members of now Spiritual Cramp and Culture Abuse. Like, that was their band from before. I want to say that was maybe 2000. So we met through there, hit it off right away. So it was just, like, at a time where, like, you sort of met people that had very like-minded, you know, sort of thoughts or approaches to music. You know, this was, like, post Have Heart sort of world too. So I feel like all of our bands sort of filled this hole that Have Heart left open, where it was for people who were interested in melodic music, maybe lyrics that were, you know, a little bit more expressive than some of the other stuff that might've been happening around that same time. It's like, that was sort of all happening around that same exact time. And then, you know, to use the word wave, like, the entire wave that happened out of Pennsylvania in 2011 was just like, I would just make jokes and be like, fucking what is in the water in Pennsylvania right now? It's like, we're getting, you know, like, there's so many bands are coming out of there, like, between the Tiger Shaws, Tidal Fights, like Menzingers, Balance of Composure, Menzingers, like, it was just, and the list just goes on and on and on. And we always felt pretty secluded and pretty lonely out in California. Cause, like, especially after Comadre left, you know, and it was like either bands in the Bay and there was, like, no one in LA other than us and Dangers, you know, we were the only California bands or, like, Southern California bands around that time that, like, had anything very sonically in common. Joyce Manor starting around that time too.
Yep.
Elliot used to play in a band with the guys in Joyce Manor in high school.
Yeah.
So he had a relationship with them early on, but, like, you know, they're starting to come up, but, like, as far as, like, aggressive music, we didn't have a lot of, you know, quote unquote allies. We had, you know, we're friends with a bunch of people in LA. Like, if you're from LA, like, the hardcore scene here, is pretty supportive of one another. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, we're playing shows and we're friends with, like, Rotting Out. We have nothing sonically in common with those guys at all. But, like, you know, we supported each other and they might not have fucked with us musically in any way, shape or form, but they always wanted, you know, everyone always kind of wanted to see each other win, which was, like, cool. You don't have to like each other's music, but you could still, you know, want to see those bands succeed and stuff like that. So, but what I'm getting at is, like, we always felt very alone on the West Coast. We're just like, fuck, man, everything is happening out in Pennsylvania and Boston and New York and whatever. So,
back to the record for the title. When did you decide on the album title? Did you have the lyric in Tilled first, or did you have that kind of kicking around already being like, I think this is a good title?
I wrote the lyrics first, and then there's two funny things for the title. Also, just for fun listener's sake, I had always called it Tilde.
Tilde, and okay. Then,
okay, but.
Okay.
Realized later on, it's actually Tilda, so I was saying it wrong forever. Oh, it's actually
and
Tilda.
And I've been saying Tild.
I know, it's fine. It's, people also have been still to this day mispronouncing our band name, but it's, I also can't get mad at them because our band name makes no sense. It's
French,
two different
Italian
languages. Yeah. It's stupid. So the two different reasons for the title is Tilda is Latin for title.
Oh, okay.
And the symbol, funny enough, so like you playing in music, you playing bands, stuff like that, you know how this goes. For listeners, you know how this goes. There's always a placeholder song title,
yeah,
before it actually gets a proper name, and often your band continues to call it the placeholder, mm-hmm, title,
yep,
because they've committed to it, whatever. So we didn't have a placeholder title, and I used to, oh, and because the intro was like this, the kring,
yes, yeah, kring, yes, yeah,
I would call the song literally, you know, play the I would do this hand waving, yeah, motion, yeah. And then I remember looking at you know,
the tilde
symbol, yeah, is this hand waving motion.
Yeah.
So there was that aspect to it that I thought was cool. And then also the fact that Tilda means title, and the opening lyric is, I'm parting the sea between brightness and me. So that, yeah, was me being ultra fucking clever. So clever. I'm just so fucking clever. So yeah, that's how that came together. Also, you know, just to be a dumb dickhead, I always really like when bands have titles or something like that, that like you don't know how to pronounce it, you don't know what to call it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what I'm saying, whether it's like, you know, it's the biggest version of it is like the Prince symbol, you know what I'm saying, you're like, what artist form, what he's,
yeah,
a symbol,
yeah,
you know, whatever. So yeah, that I think all of those things intrigued me to want to call it that.
Yeah, I played in a band briefly with a singer who would write all the set lists, but for the bass player, he would do a drawing instead of writing what the, and he wouldn't give it to him until we were on stage. So he would open up this set list and it's all drawings that he's,
oh,
supposed to interpret on the spot. And like, we played a Halloween show and the first song was Misfits, We Are 138, and it was literally 138 ticks was his first,
oh,
song.
My God.
Like shit like that. And he's just screaming on stage trying to figure out what we're playing.
Oh, but that's so good.
I could just picture, I've seen this at like Menzinger's, use the Vonnegut asshole for I Don't Want to Be an Asshole Anymore,
oh,
on their
God.
Set, like stuff like that. And just like that stuff never dies. You'll like to ask band members things about songs. They'll be like, what song is that? Oh, that's New Jammer,
yeah,
number 3 or whatever. Like,
I'm always fascinated. There's the band Ampere.
Yep.
They always, it was always just numbers. Soul Glow does that too. You look at a Soul Glow,
okay,
set list,
yeah,
or Third Face does it as well. You look at these set lists and it's literally like 14, 6, 19, 24. You're just like,
what?
How the fuck do,
yeah,
you know what that is? You know, it's fascinating.
When you're in the studio, are you a recording guy? Do you enjoy it now? Have you ever enjoyed it? Or are you kind of like, you're just kind of waiting for your turn?
I do enjoy it. I don't not enjoy it. I think that when you start to hear stuff back, it does feel really exciting. I don't like monotony. So that can feel a little old,
yeah,
where you're like listening to the same thing over and over and over. And also like watching someone try to get tones is like...
Oh, it's so
exhausting.
Painful, yeah.
It's so like, if you're not the one doing it,
mm-hmm,
it, you're just like, oh boy. I appreciate what they're doing. I think that it obviously is very rewarding in the end, but in the moment, you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do find myself being pretty present throughout the whole process, though. For the most part, I try to be as present as possible. But if it is just like a day of getting tones,
yeah,
I'm not yeah, coming around.
Do you remember feeling any pressure at all doing this
record?
Oh,
God, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I use, everyone knows the phrase sophomore slump, you know, like yeah. you sort of have this thing to live up to. You have to sort of prove that, you have to prove that you are worth, you know, still paying attention to, you know, it's like, you're not just a fluke. You weren't just like a thing. So I do think that there's a big step between Dead Horse and Parting the Sea sonically. But yeah, I remember just being real nervous. But then I remember thinking that the third record is the hardest record to write, because it's like, you have to still grow, but you can't grow so much that you, you know, it's the, like, Dangers famously have a record called, the Bend Before the Break? Shit. Something like that.
Yeah.
But the idea of it is like, you can bend, but don't break. You know what I'm saying? Like, bend really far, but don't go too far to where you're going to fuck everything up, yeah. kind of a thing. So, but by the time we got to stage four, all bets were off. We didn't give a shit anymore. Right. We're just like, if people, you know, how many hardcore bands make it to a fourth record? So at that point, we're like, we're just lucky to still be doing this.
Do you guys ever elicit, or you personally elicit feedback in that time between when that record's done, but it's not out yet? Do you have some kind of trusted people that will either shoot you straight, or you can kind of get an idea of what you've got by bouncing some songs or the whole album off of them?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There's, my brother was always somebody that I would go pick up and drive around and show him. If someone is in town, I'll do it. Like Jordan from La Dispute. I remember driving around playing him some records in the past. Pat Kinlan is another person who I've driven around and showed him stuff. It's people who like will shoot me straight. Like yeah. Pat Kinlan's not gonna. Yeah, he's not gonna
exactly.
exactly, he's not gonna. He'll. You know, I remember him one time telling me that the only song off Part of the Sea he liked was. When it first came out was Condolences, because he thought because he liked that other people thought it was fucking bad or something. He's like, I like that you made this song that like made other people feel bad or yeah. I forget what he said. But also Pat will be very kind when you're not in the room about you. Oh, yeah. You know, like I remember him telling somebody that the riff in Home Away From Here is like a riff that you can't deny. Like you can't not like the yeah. hookiness of it. Oh, yeah. He was like, it's impossible to like deny how hooky that song is.
He went on monologues during the pandemic about Lament on Axe to Grind that were like some of the kindest words I think he's probably ever said about any band.
Well, that's really nice. He's one of my favorite friends in the entire world. He's the only person that you could literally hit FaceTime to.
Yeah.
And he's gonna answer. Even if it's in the most inappropriate space for him, like he's like the guy checking out at the grocery store who's answering a FaceTime. Yeah, yeah. We're like, dude, you could have not done this, but he's funny like that.
I had him on earlier to talk about I don't think people knew his process of just like never hearing the songs in Drug Church ahead of time and just walking in and rattling it off. Like, I was like, I want to talk to this guy because I don't know anyone who does vocals like that.
Self-defense, I mean, that was always a self-defense thing too. You know, writing on the spot is so crazy. When we did that split or that collab 7-inch together, that was the first time I went in without having anything prepared. And our idea was, because we took the Bolt bus, which is like the shitty, you know, like super cheap bus from New York to Philly, to go record vocals. And and our thought was we were going to write lyrics on the Bolt bus down together, but we ended up just fucking gossiping the whole drive, just talking shit the whole drive. And we showed up at the studio, at Will Yip's studio, and he had just finished like a 12-hour day with Blacklisted, and you could see he was burnt. Like, he was like, why did I agree to record vocals for this thing? It's like 9 p.m. Why am I doing this? And then we show up. Will's like, "All right, you guys good to go?" We're like, "We gotta write lyrics." I could just see his face was like, "You pieces of shit." So that was a fun process.
When you look back on the lyrics from this album, how much of it is still you? And is some of it magnified? Because I feel like a lot of these lyrics are about that disconnect between regular life and tour life, which I'm sure now after hundreds and probably maybe close to 1,000 shows, like...
Over, oh yeah, we're at like 1,200 or something.
Okay, yeah, like how much of this still is you?
It's a funny question. You know, I used to... I do still think there's a lot of aspects that are there, which more so now is like the grass is always greener side of things, you know, where like, you know, when you're on tour, you miss home. And then when you're home, you miss tour, like that sort of a thing, you know, like that's always going to be around. I could still relate to aspects of it for sure. But there's certain lines that I have no connection to anymore at all. You know, like there's a lot, there's like references to sleeping on a hardwood floor. Those days are behind, you know, like I haven't had to sleep on a hardwood floor in a while. I'm like going through the songs in my head right now. There's like certain things that I'm like starting to see. I'm scratching the surface of topics that I like do a better job of illustrating going forward. You know, I think I was starting to feel the anxiety of people putting a lot of stock into expressing struggles and me becoming someone to other people that they feel like I have the answers when I certainly never did. And I was struggling with that always, you know, like it was like, that was around the time, you know, it was before I dealt with, you know, losing a parent or anything like that. So around this time, I'm having people wanting to talk to me about their, like maybe severe mental health struggles, about just like, you know, whether it's, manic depression or, you know, any sorts of like self-harm sort of situation, things like that. And I remember feeling so ill prepared for that and not knowing how to handle it and going to like, you know, I would always, once I got in a position to where I got to know some people in bands that were in like larger bands that had been doing this for a really, really long time. Once I felt comfortable around those people, I started asking them for like, you know, guidance in a way, like, how do you do this? How do you manage this? And I got some very valuable advice over the years. Some of the most helpful advice I ever got was a person told me, if someone's going to hit you with some really heavy stuff, you should take them seriously, but realize that sometimes someone might be saying something really gnarly to you because they want you to remember them going forward, which is like kind of a rough tactic. But it's, you know, he was like, don't take everything. He's like, add some salt in there, take some grains of salt in there. Because there was a point where, the phrase that a lot of people used very, very, very casually, which was, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. Which is one of the worst things. It's a nice sentiment in your head, you know, like if someone's saying that, like there's like this really like, but that's not a casual thing you say to somebody. That's like a very, that's a heavy burden to put on somebody.
100%.
It's like a really heavy burden to put on somebody. And I didn't know how to take that stuff, you know, and I still don't, you know, I feel like that was just a very popular phrase around like the Tumblr era, you know?
100%.
So, you know, I used to just panic when people would say that to me. And so just casually too, just be like, Hey, nice to meet you. Hey, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. I'd be like, dude, come on. After a while I would just be like, you know, like I would come up with new things. Either I would just try to change the subject immediately, or I would be like, you realize you're here because of you. Like, you are actually the person that made that possible. You know, I just wrote some dumb songs.
Have you ever, like, I know you know him, Tim Kasher, in our first episode kind of talked about that.
Oh, did
because
for through The Good Life and specifically like Game of Monogamy era when he's doing that solo record.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he's like, these are stories. And, you know, he's like, some people are like, Tim is this piece of shit that he is this guy in these songs. He's like, I also don't want to break. They've created this whole world without him. And then they put that world onto him of like, when you were cheating or you were doing this guy, he's like, these are characters. There might be fragments of me, but to fully assign this as though this is like my diary is not.
It's not valid.
It's not valid. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No. That's a brilliant point. Absolutely. Yeah. Tim is such a great writer. He was.
Oh yeah.
He was one of the first people I had on my show I've certain episodes where I was like, boy, I wish I could just do that one again now that I'm a little more confident in what I'm doing. That's a very, very great point. People, there's often times where people will take things and put it as a scripture as opposed to realizing that it might be a little less than that.
Yeah. Yeah. So around this, from my count, it looks like in 2011, you guys play about 115 shows. 2012, you're up around 100 mark. Are you guys all doing Touche full time at this point after this record comes out, or does it take another record, or are you able to do it full time?
Most of us are probably working fucking, you know, like throwaway jobs, Clayton was helping out at, with like this one artist, like just doing like office stuff. I'm bouncing in and out of working at a record store. Everybody's kind of doing odd job shit in between. But it's also that point where it's like becomes almost impossible to get hired to do odd job stuff. Yeah. 'Cause you're like, you don't want to commit to something that like actually they rely on you.
Yes,
because
yeah,
then
yeah.
You feel like a piece of shit where you're like, hey, thanks for the opportunity. Is that all right? Is it all right if I take 6 weeks off starting next week? I think I'm now learning, you know, for anyone out there that does freelance stuff full time or anything like that, I think that you have a built-in ability to hustle. It becomes a part of your livelihood where you realize like how hard, you know, you're living paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, that's especially if you live in a town like LA or New York or any place like that where rent is astronomical. It's like you become such a paycheck to paycheck minded person. So I'm probably hustling the hardest way possible, whether it's like selling shit or whatever else, you know, like finding new things to do. The band becomes full-time though in the sense of like that's our trajectory, you know.
Yeah. So we're just over 10 years now, and according to Discogs, which I know is not always the most accurate, but I think there's been over 21,000 copies of this record pressed.
Yeah.
Which is why when you hear that number, did you ever dream when you were making this that you would be this much of a hit? People would love it this much.
Certainly not. Certainly not. I mean, like, again, this was, you know, vinyl was, I mean, everyone talks about the vinyl boom now, but like that was like real, like that first wave of the vinyl boom was so massive.
Yeah.
Because now I feel like there's not the collectors who want every variant. I think those days are behind us.
I was that guy for a long time.
Totally. Same.
And
same.
I just can't afford it now, but
I think that does play in a role, play a role in it too. But yeah, the every variant era was so massive. And there's still a couple hangers on of Touche collectors. One in particular is a kid named Kane, who does have every single variant of every Touche record. And it's cool because you get to know these people personally to the point where like, I just send him variants. So he doesn't, you know, it's like, it's
so
like
he's not paying those wild prices.
Right. Or like I do my best, you know, there's a few times where he has to do some mail order himself, but like, you know, if it's like tour pressings and things like that, I always make sure that there's one set aside for Kane. The way that Converge is a band that I still collect is a lot of, cause I'm in too deep. You know what I'm saying?
I know you can't quit. And then every time they reissue like my Pedro the Lion collection, I was like,
"Is that what it is for you?"
That's one of them. But like, yeah. I had a band staying over, and they saw it. They're like, "Oh, did you have a record label?" I was like, "No, I'm just one of those guys," because they see just a whole shelf of one record.
Uh huh. Yeah, so, I don't know if you can. I don't know how well,
well
you can
see it,
but
here. It's
yeah,
wild.
The Converge collection is stupid. Yeah. Converge cursed, Envy. Those are like the three bands I probably have the most variants of still at this point. Yeah.
The one that's killing me now because they just sold their discography is Keeping Up With My Bright Eyes collection. Because
I
now
also,
480's got it all.
I know. I'm not buying the... I'm doing the companion pieces, but I'm not doing the regular ones. Because I already have like six versions of Fevers
and
Mirrors.
Plus box sets and yeah.
Dude, tell me about it.
It's out of control.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? Now that I'm saying, Bell and Sebastian is another one too.
Oh,
where
yeah.
If you see it, like the yellow, green, red things that are up there, those are all like the weird Obi stripe reissues or whatever. But like that one block up to like half of that and then half of that is also all Bell and Sebastian. But like, I was even thinking the other day, I was like, what the fuck do I need all of these versions of like, especially their later records, which like I think are cool but not great.
Yeah.
So why do I need all the versions of like the records that I'm not even the biggest fans of? That's just stupid. That's the mental illness side of what we do.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. But no, so what, you know, to get back to your question, the, you know, selling 22,000 copies of that record is crazy. It's like super, super nuts. It Survived By also did, I think like the first pressing of It Survived By, one of the variants is like 10,000 copies, which is, it's like
wild.
It's I think like the least limited version, if I'm not mistaken, is 10,000 or something.
That's
I'm gonna verify that actually as we're talking. So yeah, you know, that was super overwhelming and like holy shit, like this is super crazy. And I'm sure Deathwish was psyched.
This kid who just helped us pack stuff for 2 weeks. It's turned out all right.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have a favorite memory from this time? When you think back to this era, is there one thing, maybe it's a show, maybe it's the writing, maybe it's the recording, something like that, where you look back and you go, shit, that was my favorite part of this time?
Ooh, that's a good question. And just real quick, so yeah, the first pressing of It Survived By, the least limited copy is limited to 11,500.
That's amazing.
It's insane.
That's awesome.
It's insane. But it did take a long time for that to be repressed. Those were impressed for a very long time. So yeah, that's really funny. Okay, so favorite memory of that era. I mean, you know, I don't want to, things were, everything felt so big, you know what I'm saying? Where like, you know, in retrospect, which is, you know, maybe it's a little bit of it's maybe a little bit of a tragedy to where you sort of become a little numb to exciting things as things continue, because this is the era where it's like, oh my God, there's 300 people at this show. And it's like
our show and there's 300 people.
And it's like, holy fuck. So like, you know, playing Chain Reaction, like doing two nights of Chain Reaction and having both nights be sold out was like, I can't believe this. This is crazy. And you know, like those are some of our most like, you know, viewed videos on YouTube and things like that, which are those shows where you could just feel like the passion in the room. You know, I think that holds a lot of weight. But this is also around that same time where we start getting to go to Europe more often, and those shows are really, really crazy. And you know, getting to play places in Europe that, I mean, getting to go to Europe in general was something that I never thought I would see New York, let alone any of these other places. So like that was always really, really overwhelming, to getting to go to these places that I only ever fantasized to ever get to see. And then having people not only show up, but sing along in places that it was just like the craziest feeling in the entire world. Yeah. So all of that really, really does feel pretty remarkable. Yeah, it's hard to like pinpoint one, but I would say probably getting to do like two nights at Chain Reaction and having a record that just came out and having everyone yelling the words back at you is just like, this is unreal.
I was watching that video this morning, actually.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. It was wild. It was crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And even like, even up here in Canada, like we know Chain Reaction, like it's a legendary spot.
Yeah. It's our West Coast, or it's our Southern California Gilman. It's our, you know, West Coast CBGBs or something like that, where it's like, it's known. And it kind of makes me sad because I feel like its legacy has sort of dwindled. Like they don't get the same shows that they used to and things like that. Yeah. It'll probably have a resurgence at some point.
Yeah. The thing I kind of wanted to also talk about in the world, especially the heavier side of stuff, there's almost like a lore behind the front person where it's like, you know, every band, like, and I've always kind of went, like, one of my favorite front people is Kevin Seconds from 7 Seconds. And I think that you bring a similar kind of energy like that. Like, I was watching also the video from Hellfest that just passed. I was like, I don't know if this is a conscious decision or just because these songs get pretty dark, especially in the latter half of the discography. But to me, when I'm watching Touché play, you guys are bringing so much joy to hardcore, which I think is fairly rare. Like, I think Kevin Seconds does it. I think there's some guys like that, some people like that who do that. When you're up there, did you ever feel throughout that you had to like have a persona, or has it always easy to been just like, okay, I'm pretty vulnerable in these lyrics as is and people are receptive, so I'm just going to roll with that?
It's funny you say that. I think that there was a part of me for a while where I wish I was this considered like mysterious person, but I just don't have
mystery
it in
guy
me.
Hardcore.
I just don't have it in me to like actually be that person, you know. Like I always felt like I wanted to say thank you to everybody who ever gave us a shot, you know what I'm saying? I was trying to think of a certain lyric that somebody, I think it's a Kevin Devine lyric I'm thinking of, that he sort of illustrates what we're talking about a little bit. About wanting to be, oh no, it's also, there's a new and original song that also says that. But yeah, the idea of like creating some sort of persona that sort of like masks it, and sometimes it almost feels like an excuse to like not confront, your happiness by trying to put out this thing where you're hiding who maybe you really are for some sort of identity that is really not worth anything. And it only just sort of like puts you in a weirder spot. I mean, I'm not going to, I'd be lying if I said that like every day I want to just like, you know, fucking be the brightest person in the entire world you know, everyone has their days and things like that. But, I can't help but like literally smile on stage and be happy when things are, when it's a sick ass show, you know? But what, you know, and I think that I've said before, and I've talked to a lot of music, like music friends about this stuff too, people who like sing about darker subjects and heavier things and stuff like that. Like, there's a self-preservation that kicks in when you're performing to where you're on autopilot, you know, you're not thinking about every single line that you're saying, you know. For me, I've never, against my better judgment, like I've never done any sort of like therapy or grief counseling or anything like that. And I think that I probably still could use a lot of that stuff. But I've convinced myself of a lot of very foolish things. One of the things I've convinced myself of is like, well, if I go get my problem sorted out, how am I going to be able to write?
Yes.
Which is one of the most
like
foolish
the stand-up
things.
Comedy thing. If you're not miserable or fucked up, no one's gonna like your set. Like,
yeah, and it's like, you know, like there could be something to be said. It's like, well, if you got some clarity on some of these issues, maybe you'll be a better writer because you'll have other new things to sort of like, you'll come from a different direction with some of this stuff, which is like very incredibly valid. So maybe one day I'll get the courage and actually do some of that stuff, and it probably would help me significantly. But I've always shied away from it out of fear of losing some sort of edge. So yeah, so you know, I write these things and they're I try to be as honest as I possibly can, for better or worse. And so by the time it comes to performing these songs and singing these songs, it's like, you know, I'm on autopilot a lot of the time mentally to sort of get through them, but it will take, it would be something like someone's face, that maybe I can see that they're going through it in a relating way, or something like that. Or maybe I'm playing on an anniversary of something that was maybe traumatic or something like that, like, or around an anniversary of something that was traumatic. Like, that's when I start to sort of get into it. Or maybe if we're playing to an audience that doesn't give a shit, you know, like, there's that angst that can come out of you and be like, and then everything becomes very volatile and very serious. And then, or you're singing these songs that are like very important or very heavy or something like that, and you're looking at someone who's like, you know, talking to their friend or like texting or something like that while you're playing these songs. These sorts of things will bring out the like not great side of the emotion, you know. But if I'm playing these songs that are like, you know, potentially really heavy or heartfelt, etc., and it's to an audience that's just like singing it right back at me, like, I can't help but just have the best time, you know.
That's awesome. Now, a question I used to ask bands to, when talking about this record, kind of rank it in your discography, but I feel most are not, it's kind of pick your own favorite child. But if, say, you go to like a family dinner or something, and you got like a 13-year-old nephew or cousin or something, and he goes, "Jeremy, I want to check out your band," which album do you give them?
It's going to be Lament, honestly. And that's, and I don't mean that as some sort of a cop out, but it's just like, for me, it's like, it's our band at our absolute best.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, not only is there so much story behind it with like getting to do it with Ross, but it like, it sounds so fucking good.
Yeah.
And the songs, like, I think it's our most accessible record by far, you know, like it's got so much to it. It's our hookiest record. It does all of the things that I think we're good at doing at this point. So it's going to be Lament. But if someone said, what's a good gateway record to your band, I might say Parting the Sea feels like a pretty good entry point.
Yeah.
Because you can listen to it and you're done with it in 20 minutes. You know, it's it's over before it begins, you know?
Yeah.
So that could be helpful for people who potentially have a short attention span.
Yeah.
You know? I think a thing that I take a lot of pride in with this band is that I love that Touche is a band that people can argue their discography about. I think that's one of the coolest things. There's like a handful of bands that I think are really fun to debate that stuff with, for me personally. You know, we just mentioned Bright Eyes. I feel like that's a fun debate.
Big time.
Alkaline Trio is a fun debate. Yeah. You know, there's sort of stuff like that. So if we've entered that echelon where people have really strong opinions on what they think our best or worst record is, I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I want to end with that, man. Thank you so much for your time. That was a blast. I had a ton of fun doing that. So you also plug real quick. You do the first ever podcast weekly. If you're on the Patreon, you get the Radio Hour, which is basically your own custom playlist. You get it a day early. It's been great. There's been so many awesome episodes.
Thank you.
The Brian McTernan one recently was awesome too, because there's just so much lore out there about that guy and the bands he recorded and all that stuff. Like, it's a ton of fun hearing you deep dive with a lot of these people.
Oh, that means a lot. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, I got the first ever podcast, which is, you know, keeping me busy. It's helped me a lot throughout the old pandemic. I got that. Touche's touring a lot towards the end of this year. We got we're doing Europe with Thrice and Coheed, and then we go right to the U.S. with the Menzingers and Screaming Females, which would be a lot of fun. And then hopefully trying to write some music for next year.
Awesome.
That's the idea.
Perfect. Thanks so much again, man.
Thank you.
Thanks again so much, Jeremy, for spending that time with us and talking over Parting the Sea between Brightness and Me. Tons of great insight there. Lots of great stories. Love the recording. Just the thought to the intention of this band to go, no, we're not going to do what everybody else would do, sign to Death Wish, you know, record with Kurt, do these tours, whatever. They've always kind of taken their own route. They've always had their own path. And I think that's why now they're not only such a big band, but I believe they truly have the respect, which I think from talking to Jeremy is just as, if not more important than, you know, selling out shows and moving records. This was super fun for me. Every interview I've done so far this season has been an absolute blast. I'm having more fun than ever doing these. Thanks so much for listening. If you have any feedback, hit me up at thatonerecord@gmail.com. Sorry, thatonerecordpodcast@gmail.com. Critiques, comments, whatever, questions, love to hear it, love to hear from you. Hit us up on Instagram, thatonerecordpodcast. That's where most of the updates and all that stuff come through. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time.